Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, just about everywhere. Just search for Dog Works Radio. And calling in from California is the co-host of Mushing Radio. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Robert. It's been cold down here, but, you know, for us, cold means the 40s.
Yeah, we talked about that last episode, whether you guys break out the parkas at 40 degrees and, you know, turn up the heat and all that. You know, I have a question about that. I was going to ask you the last time I was listening to a show that was aired in Los Angeles, and it's my understanding that it's relatively warm in the day, but at night it gets real cold because of the way that the terrain is, you know, the way that things are set up, because it's sort of in a valley-type desert situation where it can get pretty cold pretty quick and temperatures change real rapidly. Is that true?
Generally, that tends to be true. And the other thing about the weather down here is for most of the time, for the majority of days, it will be sunny. So even if the temperature isn't necessarily all that warm, if you're out in the sunshine, you tend to feel warmer than if it's cloudy and windy.
Right. So you guys got your wool socks on and your park is at 40 degrees and ready to rock and roll and talk about some mushing on the radio, right?
Exactly. That's how we roll down here.
There he go. So on our last episode, Alex, we talked about the 1925 serum run and how all of that sort of works its way out in history. And now we're going to talk about the aftermath of that. Do you want to do a real quick summary of the serum run so folks that did not get a chance to listen to it may get some a heads up before we move into the next history segment?
Sure, absolutely. Just as a reminder, those who didn't listen, you can go back and listen to the archived show, which I would definitely recommend. In 1925, there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome, Alaska, and they were scheduled to get antitoxin to treat the diphtheria, but it hadn't come in on the last boat, and then the seas froze, so they weren't able to get it in over the winter. And there was a fear that this diphtheria outbreak could spread and could kill hundreds or possibly thousands of people. So a decision was made to bring in antitoxin, but because it was 1925, there were not very many planes that were equipped to fly from Anchorage to Nome. Most of the planes that were in service then, the commercial planes, were open cockpit planes, and it was very cold. The engines were not as reliable during the winter. So the decision was made to bring the antitoxin by dog sled. And it was decided that the easiest way to do this would be to ship the antitoxin by train up to Nenana, and then move it across, essentially on the Iditarod Trail, on a lot of the same ground that was run in this past year's Iditarod, and do a team of dog sled relays. So there were a number of dog sled teams that made trips of various lengths, each handing it off to the next musher who would bring it further and further. And as we discussed last time, the most important two mushers who were part of this relay were Leonard Sepala with his lead dog Togo and Balto, which was the lead dog for his name has escaped me.
Gunnar Katzen.
Gunnar Katzen, right.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you, Alex, for the quick summary. And we're going to pick up the story from there to talk about the little Norwegian musher with his little Siberians, Leonard Sepala. You know, a lot of people know the name when they hear anything about mushing. They hear the name Sepala. They know about the Siberian Husky. I'm a big proponent of the Siberians. We've had them for years in our kennel. And they're just a magnificent little breed. And I think things would have changed a little bit differently if Leonard Sepala was not involved with the serum run. And it's interesting how history sort of played its way out after the serum run. And I'm just going to read a little bit of information that I have from the internet, and then we can talk about it. Is that okay, Alex?
Absolutely.
So after the serum run, Sepala and some 40 of his dogs toured the lower 48 with an Eskimo handler. His tour ended in 1927 with a dog sled race at Poland Springs, Maine, where he accepted the challenge to race against Arthur Walden, the founder of the North New England Sled Dog Club and the owner of the famous lead dog Chinook. Despite a series of time-consuming mishaps on the trail, Sepala won the race against the bigger, slower dogs driven by Walden and his followers. The enthusiasm for sled dog racing in New England, together with the serum run publicity and the victory over Walden, made it possible for Sepala to partner with Elizabeth Ricker to establish the Siberian Husky Club at Poland Springs, Maine. This was the start of the spread of the Sepala sled dog in the United States and in Canada. In 1928, Sepala moved to his permanent home to near Fairbanks, Alaska, and in 1931, Ricker's partnership ended with him. Sled dog racing was a demonstration event at Lake Placid in 1932, where he earned a silver medal in the event. In 1946, he and his wife, Constance, moved to Seattle, Washington. In 1961, Sepala revisited Fairbanks and other places in Alaska at the invitation of the American journalist Lowell Thomas, enjoying a warm reception from the Alaskan people. Him and his wife lived in Seattle until his death at the age of 89. His wife Constance died a few years later at 88. Both are buried in Nome, Alaska. So you know, Alex, a pretty quick summary about him, but what was interesting, and we're going to talk about this on the next show with Katzen and Togo, these guys were some of the earliest rock stars, weren't they, in terms of celebrities. They really threw out the red carpet for these folks. They toured, you know, the lower 48. All of a sudden, sled dogs were on the map. What can you tell us about the Sepala saga and how he sort of became this celebrity in a time in America where, you know, news and the internet and movies and all that sort of stuff were relatively new, at least in terms of movies and film? I think it sort of changed the way people thought about mushing at that point. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And as we discussed a little bit last time, while the serum run was going on, which was sometimes called the Great Race for Mercy and known by a couple of other names, it was reported very widely in newspapers and followed by people all around the world. But because there weren't satellites and radio transmissions were harder to relay, almost all of the coverage was in print. And people would be following all of the mushers and be following how far along the trail they were and who had gone which distance. Throughout all of this, Leonard Sepala was considered one of the most important members of this relay team. And in fact, when they were planning how to get the serum from Anchorage out to Nome, one of the ideas that was floated was to have someone take it halfway and then have one team take it the other half, to meet in the middle and take it, you know, one half at a time. And Cephala was willing and able to go half of the race, which essentially would mean going about 1,000 miles, because he would have had to start in Nome and then go to the halfway point, then turn around with the serum and come back.
Right. And, you know, what I found it pretty interesting is, as we talked about these rock stars and how they sort of, you know, sort of made a big to-do about what a lot of folks didn't know much about because of the way that the news covered things back in, you know, the early 20th century. But what I thought was the coolest part of this was how they introduced sled dog sports to the Olympics in 1932 at Lake Placid. And as we mentioned, he won the silver medal in that event, and it took place with five contestants, five from Canada and seven from the United States. And it was run under the rules of the New England Sled Dog Club, twice over a 25.1 mile long course with six dogs per sled. Each sled took off at 3-minute intervals, and immediate times were given to the mushers at 4 miles, 10.6 miles, and 22.46 miles. So if folks know much about sprint mushing, this was a sprint race in the Olympics. It was the only time, to my knowledge, that sled dog sports have been a part of the Olympics, and it was set up real close to the way the Ferrandi is run, which is a very, very big race here in Anchorage. It's been around at least as long as this, I believe, this 1932 Olympics. So what do you think about sled dog sports in the Olympics? I would like to see it at least, you know, maybe as a demonstration again. What do you think?
I would absolutely love to see sled dog racing in the Olympics. I think it would be very, very exciting and very fun to watch. You know, a lot of us who are interested in mushing and in the Iditarod, when we first learn about it, one of the things that is so attractive and compelling is watching the dogs. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past many times, but these dogs are just phenomenal athletes. And for many of us, we're used to thinking of dogs solely as pets or perhaps as service dogs. We don't realize how much concentration and power and focus these animals can have. And so, you know, we look at some of these dogs running on sled teams, and even though they are definitely, many of them, especially the Siberians, are just beautiful, gorgeous animals, they also are just such amazing athletes. And I would love to see dog sledding in the Olympics, if only because I think that would put a lot more focus on how great the athletes, the real athletes, the dogs are.
I totally agree. And it's my understanding the only events that have an animal are the equestrian events, and obviously that's in the Summer Olympics. How do you feel about that in terms of, you know, it's almost a human-powered, you know, spectacle the Olympics are. Do you think that sort of changes the way that the Olympics are set up, going from more human performance events versus events that have another component, whether it be dogs or horses?
You know, I think it would be fascinating to watch, just because having the animal component definitely changes it, but it also is about how the humans interact with their canine athletes and how they train with them. And I think that would be really wonderful and amazing, and would be a great would be a great way to introduce people to the sport as well. I wanted to mention just very briefly that looking at the list of competitors for the 1932 demonstration, in Lake Placid, I noticed that one of them was Colonel Norman Vaughn, who came in 11th place, second to last. But Colonel Norman Vaughn, I believe, is someone we've touched upon a few times, is someone who ran the Iditarod a number of times, climbed a mountain in Antarctica that I believe is named after him now, and was very active in the Serum Run reenactments that were done in Alaska more recently.
Right, and I was just going to mention that the qualification to run in these Olympic Games, Norman Vaughn, as you mentioned, qualified and came in 11th. But what I found was interesting was Emil St. Goddard. He was unable to compete because of lack of financial support. You know, even in today's day and age in mushing, that's always a factor. And I know you and I have talked a lot about it on this show, about the corporate sponsors and how all that worked out. But that also is an interesting twist to the Olympics, because just up until recent times, it was considered an amateur event. You know, Michael Phelps and all those guys didn't have the big corporate sponsors when they first started. Now all of a sudden, everybody's is represented by, you know, the athletic companies, whether it be Nike or Adidas or Under Armour or whoever it is. But even back in 1932, they were still going after those corporate sponsors, which play hand in hand to a lot of mushing events. What is your take on that in the Olympics back in the day and even today?
You know, it always was a little bit of a strange differentiation to make, because in the communist bloc, the athletes were essentially supported by the state, and that was not allowed in the West. So you always had the situation where athletes from the Soviet Union would be much better trained, would be able to to devote all of their time full time to training and competing in sports, whereas athletes in the West would often have to have jobs, and there were only specific jobs that they could have. They couldn't have a job that was too related to the sport they were competing in, because then they were considered professionals as opposed to amateurs. Although there is just a lot of money now in the Olympics and in training the athletes and needing to bring in corporate sponsors, from a fan standpoint, I am much happier seeing the best athletes in the world in whatever sport, whether it's, you know, basketball or other sports where people make a living as professionals, or just, you know, sports like bobsled racing, where you know that you don't have to worry about whether someone took some sort of skiing gig or some sort of job representing a particular equipment manufacturing company that would in the past have disqualified them from competing in the Olympics.
Right. So to finish up for today, we wanted to just give down the listings of where he stood there in the Olympics. As we mentioned, he was in second place. Emil St. Goddard, it said that he couldn't compete, but for whatever reason, it shows him at first place. I don't know why that is, Alex, but I'm just reading here on the page. Emil was in first, Leonard Seppala second, Shorty Russick, I believe is how you pronounce his name, a Canadian, was in third, Harry Wheeler, also a Canadian, in fourth, Roger Haynes, from the United States, was fifth, Raymond Poyet, I believe is how you pronounce that, is in sixth, Jack Delfalco, seventh, Stuart Belkamp at 8th, Harry Murphy 9th, Dexter Sears 10th, Norman Vaughn 11th, and a woman, Eva Seeley, competed, and she was in 12th. I find that amazing. If you know anything about Short Seeley, that's also another good story maybe we can tell in the future. But as we talk about Seppala, you know, his legacy sort of lives on, and to close the show, there is an award for a participant in the Iditarod called the Leonard Sepala Award. What can you tell us about that one?
Well, you know, Leonard Sepala is considered among among all fans of dog racing, is considered pretty much, I would say, the seminal figure in dog racing. And so the Leonard Sepala Award is one of the most highly thought of and coveted awards that is given out in the Iditarod. I'm not sure if it has been given from the first race. Do you know that offhand?
I don't know right offhand.
Okay, but anyway, the Sepala Award is considered the humanitarian award. So it is given to it's given to the musher who, I believe, I'm not sure what the exact wording of it is, but I believe it is given to the musher who best exemplifies the spirit of the Iditarod, particularly with regard to dog care.
Right, right.
Is that correct?
Yes, it's different than the Vet Award. That's a very highly coveted award as well. But the Humanitarian Award is a very coveted award in the Iditarod in that it's one of those that you know that everybody's striving to get. Usually, when you attend a mushing event, there are several awards that are given at every race. One of them is the Humanitarian or Sportsmanship Award. The other one is the Vet Award. And, of course, all the awards for first and second place. And then, of course, the Red Lantern. So I believe even in the Iditarod, if you don't win, if you get one of these highly coveted awards, including the Leonard Sepala Humanitarian Award, it shows your respect for the trail. It shows your competitiveness. It shows you out there on the trail doing what you're supposed to do and just not out there going through the paces and, you know, making your way to Nome. You're doing something very special out there on the trail to get this Sepala Award.
Right. And a lot of times these awards recognize the sort of intangible things that mushers do on the trail, whether it is stopping to help somebody, making sure that things are safe for other competitors. But it's that sort of activity that is really not just looking out for yourself and looking out for your team and looking out for how well you do in the race, but really looking out for everyone and making sure that everyone is able to complete the race and everyone is able to stay safe.
Exactly. Well, Alex, we're out of time here for today's show. Anything you want to say in closing?
You know, people who want to learn more about either the Serum Run or Leonard Sepala, I would encourage people to do that. There are a bunch of books that we've talked about in the past that have a lot of information on them. For me, the more I learn about these people, these seminal figures in mushing and the history of mushing, the more inspirational it is, and the more, frankly, I see what they set up and what they strove to do carried forward in almost all mushers that I meet today.
Excellent. Well, Alex, thank you very much for joining us, and until next time, goodbye.
Thanks.